you. We're going to be looking at provisions within the Constitution, and the last couple times I've given out constitutions, but if you don't have one, we have one here. So anybody who needs one, just indicate so, and we'll make sure that you get one. This is the third talk we have had since I started this series last spring. And remember, the topic that we began with was the end of the Constitution, which was pretty dramatic. But what I was really talking about is how we have deviated in many respects from the document, the principles that the framers first put forward. And we talked first about civil liberties, essentially the relationship between the federal government and individuals. The second lecture, we talked about growing presidential power, essentially the relationship between the branches. Tonight, I want to talk about the relationship between the federal government and the states. Okay. Nearly two dozen states have condoned medical marijuana in defiance of federal restrictions. Washington and Colorado have now legalized it. And at least 23 states have considered bills that nullify the Affordable Care Act of 2010. And we have a significant number of states that have taken action relative to federal gun laws and the enforcement of federal gun laws. And so I thought it would be appropriate and interesting for us to talk about the relationship between federal law, the U.S. Constitution, state law, state actions, state rights in general. And part of that is the issue of nullification that comes up, and we will talk about that. The U.S. Constitution is a very interesting piece of work in the sense, as I said, it lays out relationships. It lays out relationships between individuals and the federal government. It lays out relationships between the three branches, between the federal government and the states, and it lays out relationships and obligations from states to other states, which maybe we'll have a time to do that in the future. We won't have it tonight. But what I want to talk about in terms of our relationship between the federal government and each state is the whole idea of federalism. Federalism is the idea that we have a sovereign nation comprised of sovereign states. And the framers, you've probably heard me say before, were deeply suspicious of centralized power. They just pried the British boot off their throat, and the last thing they wanted to do was to create an opportunity for an American tyrant to take the place of the British. So they decided the best way to deal with power was to chop it in little pieces. They wanted to make sure that no one governmental body, no one individual could accumulate power and essentially then oppress others, take away the hard-fought freedom that people had just acquired. So we're used to the idea of sort of the horizontal division of power. We all sort of understand separation of powers, three branches, and then we even cut the legislative branch up another time into two branches. So horizontally, we sort of have it in our heads. But we also cut power vertically, okay, that the federal government has certain powers that are exclusively theirs in which the states cannot interfere, but also the Constitution gives particular powers to the states that are beyond the reach of the federal government. So what we're going to talk about today is sort of the interplay between those. And the first thing we have to do is sort of understand how the Constitution arranges these relationships. And federalism is, in fact, in the Constitution. I'm going to quote from the 10th Amendment, which, if you want to follow in your Constitution, is on page 23. And it's always interesting language in the Constitution. You get these knots that seem to mean the other way around. But what it says is, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Well, the final little bit there, or to the people, is a nod to the fact that we have a popular sovereignty, that the people actually hold the powers. They are the ones that hand out the power. They divvy it up. It essentially is all in their hands, and anything that hasn't been expressly handed out remains in the hands of the people. But I'm interested in this division that is laid out here. What they're saying is that there are certain powers that are given to, I'm going to distill it down here, given to the federal government. We call those delegated powers. Okay? And delegated powers, you remember back from fourth grade, these are the ones that are listed. You're going to find those in Article 1, Section 8, for example, that tells you that Congress has the power to declare war, to regulate commerce, to mint coins, all of that sort of laundry list of specific powers. Okay? So Congress has delegated powers. The states have reserved powers. We've got this little overlap. If you think of a Venn diagram, we have this little overlap of concurrent powers where both the states and the federal government have the ability to engage in certain activities. Both have the right to tax. Both have the right to organize court systems to provide police and fire protection. So there are a number of things that both governments are going to do sort of in their sphere of influence. But what we want to look at is this relationship between the two. In other words, when can the states reach into federal activities, if at all? When can the federal government reach into state activities or limit or regulate the states? Under what particular circumstances are we talking about here? So we have this arrangement of divided powers, delegated powers to the federal government, reserved powers to the states. Essentially, when we talk about reserved, we mean we're going to give certain powers to the federal government. We're going to specify them. Everything that's left over goes to the states. So anything that isn't specifically given to the federal government, left over to the states or to the people. However, we have to have some sort of standard for evaluating this because, of course, everybody's going to claim to have certain powers. In other words, if the states say that's our power, the federal government says that's our power, how do we sort it out? Well, the framers gave us sort of the template for doing that in Article 6, and you're going to find Article 6 on page 15 in your Constitution. And this is one that's going to take a little translation, so we're going to do it. We're going to do it slowly here. And we really want the second clause, that second paragraph. All right. And this is going to give us the template. This is going to give us the formula for deciding who has the power in any given situation. And Article 6 says, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land." And we're going to stop there. We're going to keep going in a minute, but I want to make sure we've got this. So the Constitution says that there are three items or three sort of categories of authority that are the supreme law of the land, are the highest law, sovereign law. U.S. Constitution, laws pursuant to the Constitution, and treaties, federal treaties. Essentially, these three items trump. They're the high cards that we play. And what the Supremacy Clause tells us is any time we have a conflict between federal law, federal action, federal constitution, state law, state action, state constitution, based on a conflict with the U.S. Constitution, a conflict with a federal law made pursuant to the Constitution, or a federal treaty, the federal government trumps. Now, sometimes people say, well, that means they can do everything. It doesn't mean they can do everything, and I'll explain some cases in a few minutes. What that means, though, is that there is a limitation on federal power. In other words, for the federal government to interfere, to step into the sphere of the states, they have to be able to hang their hat on one of these three hooks. They are justified in taking action only if there is a conflict with the U.S. Constitution or a conflict relative to federal law pursuant to the Constitution or a conflict with a U.S. treaty. If one of those three situations don't exist, federal government is out of it. Okay? They have to step back. So anytime we evaluate this sort of conflict of power, we're going to want to know, is there a constitutional provision at issue here? Are we dealing with a federal law that is a reflection of the constitutional power of Congress? or are we dealing with a treaty? If one of those three elements are not part of the equation, the federal government is hands off. Okay, so that's the first way we're going to approach this. Now, if we continue on, we go back to our language. Okay, so shall be the supreme law of the land, those three things, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Okay, time for translation. Okay? What that means when it says anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding, what that means is the states cannot insulate themselves from federal action by passing a state law or putting a provision in their constitution. I'll give you an example. Several years ago, you may remember this case, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court was a man named Roy Moore, Judge Roy Moore. And it's an elected position in the state of Alabama. Judge Moore ran on a platform of putting Christian values back into the justice system in Alabama, very popular, elected very handily, became the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. And one night, literally, in the dark of night, he had a large stone monument etched with the Ten Commandments brought into the state Supreme Court building and put on display. So people came in the next morning, here's the monument, it's lit, velvet ropes, whatever. So people coming in to go to work in this state building, going to court in this state building, were then faced with this religious icon. Well, obviously somebody filed suit. That's what happens in those circumstances, arguing that this was a violation of the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution. It ultimately goes to court. And, of course, the challenge came under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the Establishment Clause. And Judge Roy Moore argued, no, wrong. Okay, we shouldn't be looking at the U.S. Constitution. We should be looking at the Alabama Constitution, because the Alabama Constitution not only recognizes God, but directs the people of Alabama to honor God. So, in fact, the placement of this icon in the Alabama State Supreme Court building is perfectly congruent with the Alabama Constitution. Well, it seems like that's an interesting argument, okay, except for the language that we find here in Article 6. We go back to this language that says anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. So what that says is it doesn't matter what the Alabama Constitution says. It doesn't matter what laws Alabama may have passed relative to religious materials in public spaces. We have the conflict. We have a conflict between the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, First Amendment Establishment Clause, and state action. So we have one of those three things that the Constitution requires for the federal government to trump. We have a conflict between state action and the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution prevails. It's the supreme law of the land. And federal district court struck down the action of Alabama and directed that the monument be removed. Now, it didn't stop there. The Alabama Legal Ethics Commission took action against Judge Moore. And the argument was that this issue of national supremacy, is so clearly written and settled in our law that Judge Moore's position that somehow Alabama was insulated by their state constitution was nothing more than a pretense, and that as a lawyer and a judge, he essentially should have known better. And he was removed from the bench in Alabama. He lost his judgeship, and then I believe he and the Stone Monument began a tour around the country talking about religious rights. But I use that example because it shows us that when there is a conflict between a state constitution and the U.S. Constitution, national supremacy applies. Okay, the national position is paramount, is supreme. Okay. Now, the second thing the second part of that sort of three-part test, Constitution, laws pursuant to the Constitution, and then treaties, I want to talk about laws pursuant to the Constitution because that sort of leaves you with the idea, well, that would be any federal law, and that's not true, okay? We don't have a situation where federal law trumps always. Doesn't work that way. So what do I mean when I say federal law is pursuant to the Constitution? Well, I think that probably the best way to think of this is implied powers. We all know about delegated powers, but the Supreme Court has also recognized that Congress has implied powers, powers that are not exactly written down. And this goes back, to a case from, 1819. Okay, McCullough v. Maryland. Now, unlike my students, you don't have to remember that name. I always say, you have to remember this one. And the situation here was based on a dispute between the state of Maryland and the federal government. And the situation was that the federal government wanted to put a building associated with the federal bank in Maryland. Now, from the beginning, Alexander Hamilton had wanted there to be a national bank. This is a precursor of the Fed, okay? Wanted there to be a national bank. George Washington was resistant. Finally, by Washington's second term, Hamilton sort of wore him down. Well, there were a lot of states who believed that this was an illegitimate action by the federal government, that there was no provision in the delegated powers of the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, giving Congress, federal government, the ability to create a national bank. And so Maryland got its backup. And what they tried to do in Maryland is they tried to place taxes on this federal government operation, and we won't go into any more detail about that. You might want to look into the case more if you're interested. But this set up a conflict, okay? And the federal government said, no, you can't tax us, you can't interfere with us, national supremacy. And Maryland said, well, that's fine, but where's this provision in the U.S. Constitution? Where's the provision in law allowing you to do this? Where's the U.S. treaty? You don't have any of these things. National supremacy doesn't apply. Well, at the time, John Marshall was Chief Justice. They heard the arguments on this. They retired, and ultimately he delivers the opinion of the court. And in the course of delivering that opinion, he says, in fact, the federal government has two kinds of power. They have those delegated powers that are laid out in Article 1, Section 8, but they also have implied powers, powers that are not written down per se. And he used as a justification for the existence of these rights the very last paragraph in Article 1, Section 8, which you're going to find on page, I didn't make a note of this, page 7, yes. And the very last paragraph, the last clause, says that Congress has the power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. And what the court said this means, this necessary and proper clause, is that while the framers laid out specific powers and authority for Congress, they also recognized that certain kinds of activities would be necessary to put these powers into operation. Okay? And so the framers were not only giving Congress the power to exercise these particular authorities, but they were also giving them permission to do whatever it took to make these powers operational. For example, up until the 1970s, the way we filled the ranks of the military or the army in this country is we had a draft. There's no provision in Article 1, Section 8, or anywhere else in the Constitution that gives Congress the power to compel participation in the military, to use a draft. Okay. So it could certainly be argued this isn't a power that Congress has. But this idea that the Necessary and Proper Clause creates a justification for activities that are tied to and necessary for the operation of for specific or delegated powers applies here. Congress doesn't have direct authority to have a draft, but they do have the duty and the authority to create and maintain an army. Okay? Well, the framers necessarily recognized that they were going to have to take certain actions to do that. So it would be unreasonable to say, well, they have a power to create, maintain armies, but anything you might do to accomplish that, since it isn't listed in the Constitution, isn't available, isn't a legitimate action of the federal government. So ultimately what we get is as we look at this relationship between the states and the federal government, is we get this idea that the Necessary and Proper Clause is an indication that there are powers that Congress has beyond those which are delegated. And the way we look at implied powers or the way we evaluate them is this particular action tied to a delegated power, reasonably tied to a delegated power? So what happened in the case with the National Bank is while there is no specific authorization to Congress to create a National Bank, what you find in Article 1, Section 8 is that Congress is charged with the duties to lay and collect taxes, to pay debts and provide to pay for debts, to borrow money on the credit of the United States, to mint coins, to print currency. And so the court recognized that the creation of a national bank was necessary and proper in order to pursue these delegated powers. So when we're talking about the Supremacy Clause, when we have a situation where the issue turns on the U.S. Constitution, laws pursuant to the Constitution reasonably attached to those delegated powers, or a U.S. treaty, the federal government will trump. The federal government will preempt the states. In the absence of one of those three things, the states stand strong. Whoops, as I'm dropping my stuff all over the place. So let's talk about what that relationship looks like in real life. Okay? And we're going to look at constitutional limitations on state action where the federal government fills the field, essentially calls the shots. And then we're going to look at situations where the states have rights that protect them against incursions of federal power. Okay, so let me give you a couple of examples on limitations on the states. Actually, Article 1, Section 10 has a number of prohibitions on state actions. We're not going to go through that. That's where you're going to find things like the state governments are prohibited from taking actions on war, from certain kinds of behaviors that are exclusively federal. But what I want to talk about is how this plays out. Now, I already mentioned the Ten Commandments, which is a situation where we had conflict. The federal government ruled no matter what the state constitution said. I want to use an example from here in Michigan. Now, if you live in Michigan, you cannot avoid trash. It's everywhere, okay? If you're driving down the highway, you know, there's a big truck and stuff is blowing off the top. If you're driving around in the summer, you have the windows down. If people do that anymore, you sort of will drive into the arôme du garbage that exists in various places where there's landfill. It's everywhere. Now, practically no politician in this state runs for office without having as part of their platform that they are going to stop the flow of trash into this state, right? But nothing ever changes. Why?
Too many landfills.
But why do we have so many landfills? Where's this trash coming from? Some of it from Canada, some of it from other states, okay? So why, if we've got all of these politicians that are hot to stop this influx of trash, why hasn't it happened? Because of the limitations that we have on states. And I guess we will go to Article 1, Section 10, which you're going to find on page 8 in your book. And we'll just go through them quickly since we're here. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one of the things that isn't here, one of the limitations that isn't here, but is here in practice, is that the federal government retains the exclusive power to regulate commerce. Commerce and trade between the U.S. and other countries and between the states. That reflects a problem we had under the Articles of Confederation, the governing document we had before the Constitution. And under the Articles, as the economy declined, they had some real, they had a depression. They had some real problems, and we began to see competitive behavior between the states. Trade barriers were put up, tariffs were put in place. It caused the country to spiral economically to an even greater degree. So one of the goals for some people as they came into the Constitutional Convention was to keep this from happening again. So the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, confers the right to regulate interstate trade and commerce exclusively to the federal government. Article 1, Section 10 says that states cannot enter into treaties or confederations, into agreements. Now, some of that trash that comes into Michigan comes as the result of a treaty. And by the way, we send trash to Canada. People don't really talk about it. And we send really nasty stuff like medical waste and stuff like that. So while we have our panties in a bunch about what's coming in, we're sending some pretty nasty stuff to them. And it is done as a result of a treaty. Well, in Michigan, we want to see this trash stopped. We have a problem. Our state government can't take that kind of action because, one, the interstate transfer of trash, the international movement of trash, is commerce. People pay money to bring their trash here. And as such, the federal government has the final say. And the federal government has not seen fit to limit the amount of trash coming into Michigan, has not allowed the state of Michigan to take action, whether it has to do with international trade or interstate. Because some of that trash that comes from the more populated states on the East Coast who have simply used up all of their space. So Michigan is in sort of a bind. We say we don't want this trash. The trash is coming as a result of international and interstate trade. States' hands are tied relative to that. Some of it is coming in as the result of a treaty. States cannot create treaties, cannot interfere with treaties. Treaties are part of the supreme law of the land. So is Michigan without power here? Not exactly. Okay, remember, we've got delegated powers, those powers that are congressional, federal, and some of those are exclusive powers like commerce. But then we've also got those reserved powers, those powers that the states have that the federal government cannot interfere with. And one of the powers that the states have, and they have the ability to exercise this without interference, is their ability to tax. They can tax individuals and entities within the confines of the state. Well, as that trash comes in, it costs money to dump it, all right? You pay the private landfill owner money to back your truck up and dump the trash. You also pay a tipping fee, which is a state tax. In other words, every time a truck dumps trash in the state of Michigan gets a tax, gets a fee from that. Well, one of the things that has made Michigan sort of the mecca for trash, this incredibly attractive destination for trash haulers, is that our tipping fees are just about the lowest in the country. So from a financial perspective, it makes sense to truck to Michigan. Overall, the costs are low. Well, Michigan at any point could simply raise the tipping fees, which would make us a much less desirable destination. Let's say, I'm just making this up, let's say if we went from $3 to $15, that would add a significant cost to the trash load that would be coming here. Michigan doesn't want to do that. Why? Because we must, if we are doing this from a taxing authority, it has to be done in a non-discriminatory way. Well, it's not just other states and other countries that dump trash here. Some cities have filled up their landfills, Ann Arbor, for example, which means that we truck and dump our trash somewhere else. So if the state of Michigan wants to raise its tipping fees, it can't just do it on out-of-state or international trash, because that's clearly an attempt to interfere with international commerce. It can, however, raise the tipping fee on everyone. The political problem, of course, is then that means people in Ann Arbor are going to have to pay more to have their trash carried away. People in Birmingham are going to have to pay more to have their trash carried away. So a political decision has been made not to increase those tipping fees. And so the trash continues to flow, not because the state of Michigan is barred by the U.S. Constitution from taking action, but they are barred by the U.S. Constitution from discriminating against international or interstate trade. They're unwilling to take the action that would increase the cost for all because of the political consequences of raising taxes on state interests. So you can kind of see how that plays out. The federal government has exclusive powers around around commerce, but the states have the power to tax without interference in their sphere of influence. Michigan has determined it does not wish to increase the taxes that way, and so essentially we are not in a position to interfere with the incoming loads of trash, both from New Jersey and from Canada. Okay. Now let's talk about the limits on on federal power. And this is going to take us into sort of this discussion about nullification. There are a whole list of limitations on the federal government that are laid out in Article 1, Section 9. These are things that, like, no bills of attainder, no ex post facto laws, the conditions under which the writ of habeas corpus can be set aside, et cetera. But the main limitation on the federal government is the Bill of Rights. And just, I'm going to take a second here to go off on a little tangent, because it is so distressing to me when I see it. The Bill of Rights and the U.S. Constitution protects you from the government, okay? So some of you may have followed the Duck Dynasty, brouhaha, where the patriarch of the Duck Dynasty family in an interview made anti-gay comments. As a result, A&E, the parent company of the show, put him on probation for, I don't know, 35 minutes or something, but claimed he was going to be suspended from the show, took action against him, which immediately erupted in this debate about how his rights were being abridged, his First Amendment rights were being taken away from him. Your rights are good against the government. Okay, they're not good against other individuals or private entities. If the federal government had stepped in, or the state government or the local government, punished him for those comments, or in some way acted against him as a result of those statements, we would have a constitutional problem. Okay, the First Amendment does not protect you from the outrage of others. It does not protect you from actions people may take to boycott your endorsers. In other words, just because people suffer negative consequences, whether that's at work, whether that's in their neighborhood, whether that is in their circle of friends, the fact that they suffer negative consequences for things that they say, that doesn't mean that their First Amendment rights are being violated. So an important thing to keep in mind and mention to others when you see this come up is that the Bill of Rights protects you against abuse by the government. It does not protect you against actions of private individuals or private entities, as another example. Let's say that you belong to a church, and the pastor has said that any woman who wears a skirt above her knee will be excommunicated, will be thrown out of the church. You wear a skirt that's a little bit too short, pastor throws you out. You say, you can't do that. That is a violation of my rights. I have freedom of religion under the First Amendment. You do. But that is not good against your church because your church is not the government. Your church is a private entity. So the thing to keep in mind is that while the Bill of Rights is the greatest limitation on federal government power, the limitation is on the government, not on private entities, private individuals. So the Bill of Rights, the provisions within the First through the 10th Amendment, 14th Amendment, those protect you against governmental abuse. Okay, that rant is done. We'll come back to what we were talking about. It just drives me crazy every time I see it. When Laura Schlesinger got into all of the trouble for the multiple use of the N-word on her radio show, again, there was this hue and cry that because people were boycotting her sponsors, because she ended up losing her radio show, that this was some sort of direct and nefarious violation of her First Amendment rights, when all of those things happened as a reaction by private entities and private individuals. Not a First Amendment problem, not government action. Okay, now, as I said earlier, we don't have a system, no matter what some people may say, where the federal government is always able to trump the states. And I want to talk about two cases, and they're going to fall into this nullification issue as we move on. The first case is a case from 1995. It's called U.S. v. Lopez. Again, you're not in my class. You don't have to remember that. All right? But this had to do with federal gun-free school zones. In other words, this was a federal law that said anybody who brought a firearm into a zone within a certain distance of a public school could be prosecuted under federal law. Excuse me, could be prosecuted under federal law and punished. Mr. Lopez, who actually was a student, brought a gun into a school in Texas, was arrested, was prosecuted. He challenged the federal law in this case, saying that the federal government had no justification for regulating this. In other words, when we were talking about this school, it was not a federal, it was not owned by the federal government. There was no federal role to be played. Essentially, the federal government essentially said, we're going to put this law in place in every state relative to all public schools. And the challenge was, where is the constitutional justification for this? In other words, what is your constitutional basis for creating and imposing this law? Well, one of the things you're going to find with the federal government is whenever they're challenged about where is your authority here, where is this laid out in the Constitution? Because remember, they can only do things that they have been granted power under the Constitution. And they have sort of, there are sort of these two run home to mama arguments. One is necessary and proper clause, okay, as you might expect. The other one is the commerce clause, okay? We have the right to regulate commerce. Well, let's sort of think about how this argument would work. Well, we don't think about it. It's actually how it did work. Essentially, the federal government said, we are legitimate in our regulation of these non-federal spaces because we have the right under the U.S. Constitution to regulate commerce. Okay. So how do you get a gun? You buy it, right? Whether you buy it in a gun store or out of a guy's trunk, you buy it. It's an exchange of revenue. So the federal government said, since guns are an item of commerce, we have constitutional authority to impose laws that deal with guns, essentially anywhere, anytime. It's a very interesting argument. ultimately it goes to the Supreme Court. So essentially what the federal government was arguing is that any time they can draw a connection between interstate commerce, no matter how attenuated that might be, and regulation, law, that they are essentially home free constitutionally. Supreme Court did not see it that way. As a matter of fact, they said if they were to embrace the federal government's argument about this particular case, that essentially it would create a regulatory regime where nothing would be off the table. In other words, if we let the government, the federal government, regulate anything that can be tied to commerce, there would be nothing beyond the reach of the federal government. And so essentially the Supreme Court said, stop. Whoops. Stop. You don't have this kind of authority. You can't simply assert federal authority around any item, any situation where there is even the most minimal commerce issue. And so the Supreme Court pushed back the federal government. And, in fact, the gun-free school zones were struck down as an improper exercise of federal authority, a violation of states' rights. They went into state government and took action against state-owned spaces. The other case is a case called Prince v. U.S. It's 1997. This had to do with the Brady Bill, the Brady Act. And one of the provisions in the Brady Bill was that there had to be background checks for anyone who was purchasing a gun at a gun shop, perfectly within the federal government's ability to set this sort of regulatory scheme in place. The rub came in that the federal government directed that those background checks would be done by local and state police authorities. That essentially, this is the federal law. Background checks are required. You guys are going to do it. Well, there were a number of challenges from state police agencies and sheriffs in specific localities. And their argument was that the federal government was impermissibly, unconstitutionally reaching into that exclusive sphere of state power, where they organize their own state government, they supervise and direct state employees. And essentially their argument was, look, the states are not the handmaidens of the federal government. The federal government can't tell the states how to behave, can't tell them what they must do. And in fact, the Supreme Court agreed with that, again saying that the states are not the handmaidens of the federal government. Federal government can certainly have laws, and they can certainly enforce their own laws, but they cannot force the states to implement federal regulation or to enforce federal laws. As a matter of fact, the way the court put it is that this imposition, this direction, this requirement that the states behave in a particular way violated the sovereign powers of the state. So these two cases really give us sort of a clear sense of limitations on federal government. There has to be some sort of justification for federal intervention in sort of state areas of authority. Simply invoking the necessary and proper clause or the commerce clause ain't going to do it. And the court has become very suspicious of those kinds of arguments. And the federal government cannot direct states to behave in a particular way, cannot direct states to implement or enforce federal law. This becomes important. We go back to those issues that I started with at the beginning. Okay, so we got a couple of cases that I think we can look at in terms of this idea of nullification or sort of state pushback on federal laws. Missouri, they're about ready to pass, I believe. They may have passed it now. A bill that renders almost all federal gun laws void in the state. And they attempted to make it a crime for federal agents to enforce them in the state. So let's keep that in mind here because we're going to come back to it. Missouri says it's against the law to enforce federal gun laws in the state, and we will not recognize the validity of any federal gun laws. Okay? Montana in 2009 passed a law which purports to exempt any gun manufactured and kept within the state from federal regulation, okay? Essentially, their argument is if it's made in the state, it's not interstate commerce, we don't have to do it. Well, it's interesting to sort of look at how these are actually being handled, okay? The issue of of Missouri, okay? They say that federal gun laws are void in the state of Missouri. That's not what the court said. The court didn't say that the federal government could not regulate guns. What the court said is that the federal government couldn't make states enforce and implement those laws. The state of Missouri cannot step in and keep the federal government from enforcing in their state these laws. In other words, federal government, DEA, ATF, they have a constitutional right to be active in the enforcement of federal law. Those federal laws are legitimate. They emanate from the legitimate police powers, the legitimate constitutional powers of the federal government. The states don't have to enforce them themselves. Their state police, their deputies can essentially ignore those laws, but the states cannot interfere with the federal government's enactment and enforcement of those laws. Now, Montana argues that they do not have to enforce any federal laws relative to guns that are manufactured in the state. This would look like, well, this follows the Lopez case because the federal courts were unwilling to recognize the Commerce Clause argument there. That's not the way that the federal courts have seen this. Their argument is that the government does have the ability to regulate certain elements of commerce, even if that particular item is manufactured within a state. So the courts essentially said the federal government has the right to put these laws in place. And the fact that you argue, well, this particular gun was made in this state and never left the state, is not going to be adequate to set aside federal law. So in both of these cases, the states argued that they had a constitutional right to ignore and in both cases, to deem these laws, these federal laws, to be unconstitutional, to be void in their states. Courts in both cases stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. And that brings us to this whole idea of nullification. The sort of argument for nullification, or the concept of nullification, is one that's been around for a long time. And the idea here is that the argument says that the federal government exists by the will of the states, and therefore the states have the ultimate right to determine which federal laws are constitutional. And if a state deems a federal law to be unconstitutional, they can ignore it. They can simply refuse to implement it, refuse to allow it to be implemented. Now, this is a bad penny that just keeps turning up and turning up and turning up. It was discredited at the time that it first was put forward, and I'm sorry to say that Thomas Jefferson was one of the people that tried to argue this, and by the way, he wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. People sometimes forget that. And this, later in his life, he began to argue this idea of nullification. But there are a couple of arguments against it, some historical, some more recent. James Madison, father of the Constitution, he wrote in 1800 that this idea of nullification, or these state assertions of unconstitutionality of federal law, he said, quote, they are expressions of opinion, and that they exist for, quote, exciting reflection, okay? The expedition on the judiciary, on the other hand, are carried into immediate effect, again, a translation. It's nice to know what you think, states, but it is the federal courts, and under the U.S. Constitution, the final word on all things constitutional is the U.S. Supreme Court. It is for the U.S. Supreme Court to determine what is and is not constitutional. And when we have situations where there is a conflict between state action, state law, state constitution, and the U.S. Constitution, laws pursuant to the Constitution, or U.S. treaties, there's federal preemption. Federal law, the federal constitution, is the law of the land. Courts, most recently in 1960, and it's come up again and again, but the Supreme Court said in 1960 that nullification is illegal defiance of constitutional authority. So there is no historical support for this idea that states have a constitutional right to reject federal law in its entirety if they believe it to be unconstitutional. There is no legal authority for that position, but I can guarantee you, probably as a result of the State of the Union message last night, you will find people on television this week again talking about nullification, perhaps talking about secession. Okay, so let me take questions. I hope that was clear. I'm sorry. Are there questions?
Could you just raise your hand? I'll bring the microphone around for questions.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to recall on what basis the federal government stepped in to the lunch counter, the 60s lunch counter incidents throughout the South.
They used the Commerce Clause. That essentially that because these were issues of commerce and or public accommodation. Now, I will tell you that as you look at this issue historically, the Commerce Clause and sort of it being a font of federal power, that we really saw a gradual enlargement of that power and recognition of that power really up until the 1980s. But particularly in the 1960s, the Warren Court was more than willing to let the federal government take action in places that a lot of people would have thought were within the jurisdiction of the states, things like desegregation, workplace regulation, wage and hour, that sort of thing. So that went on for quite some time, where the court was accepting of that and was willing to side with the federal government in terms of their power there. That changed as court personnel changed. And as you get the Rehnquist Court, there is a reluctance to sort of support that really in some ways unbridled sort of federal power. And essentially this argument that anything that can even remotely be deemed commerce falls within the ambit of federal power. And that's when we begin to see the Lopez case and the Brady case, where you are getting a sort of reassertion of federalism and sort of a renewed willingness to sort of willingness to sort of enforce this constitutional division. I really think that under the Warren Court and even the Burger Court after, you had sort of a blur, and I think between the two spheres, federal power, state power, and I think that the state or the federal power really was enlarged, and I think that whether you like the decisions of the Rehnquist Court and now the Roberts Court, I would suggest. I would suggest that perhaps they are hewing more closely to that constitutional division of powers than perhaps the Warren Court did. Though, personally, I like the things that happened in the 60s, but we're sort of talking about the clinical, we're taking a clinical look at the constitutional language.
Can you explain the Affordable about how the Affordable Care Act and the states carrying out the act on behalf of the federal government is working.
Well, they don't have to carry out the act on behalf of the federal government. What the federal government tried to do is they essentially said, what we want you to do, we're going to put this in place and we're going to give you a lot more money for Medicaid. If you will expand Medicaid, we're going to give you money to do that. Now, one of the issues that went before the court was whether or not the federal government could force the states to enlarge their Medicaid programs in order to essentially to force them to do that to implement the Affordable Care Act. And the Roberts Court said, no, you can't do that. That takes us back to the Brady case, or the Prince case, which is just because the federal government wants something done doesn't mean that they can make the states do it. Now, how do we usually handle that? We dangle money, okay? Federal government can't set uniform speed limits for the country. Federal government doesn't have the constitutional power to set a drinking age nationally. Okay? But yet we seem to have uniform speed limits. We seem to have uniform drinking age. Why? Because the federal government has conditioned the receipt of certain kinds of federal funding on compliance with their desires. So highway funds, for example, have now been conditioned. This is a lot of money for some states. This is millions and millions and millions of dollars, if not billions. The federal government has conditioned receipt of federal highway dollars on blood alcohol minimums, on drinking age requirements, and on speed limits, I believe. And some states have been very belligerent, and they've said, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this. Montana was very resistant to putting a speed limits in place because they had none. They used to call the highway the Montana bond. And they said, we're not going to do it, we're not going to do it. And they went right up to the precipice, right up to the edge, and recognized that the loss to the state in terms of dollars was more than they could possibly bear. And so grudgingly, they agreed to put the law in place. Now, that is not the federal government requiring the states to do that. And there have been lawsuits where states have said this is extortion. Okay, they're making us do this. It's unconstitutional. And what the court has said is, look, the federal government doesn't have to give the states a dime. And if they give it, they are certainly free to attach strings. So a lot of what we see that looks like sort of federal law is, in fact, state law that is being put in place as a way to get certain kinds of things. In other words, the federal government buys them off, okay?
Considering the Citizens United case before the Supreme Court, what could the state of Michigan do to prohibit or limit contributions by corporations and so forth?
Well, if we go back to the analysis we did earlier, which is that whenever there is a conflict between state action, law, or constitution, and U.S. Constitution, federal law pursuant to the Constitution and treaty, federal preemption, federal law, you know, the feds trump. The Supreme Court said that it is a constitutional right, a U.S. constitutional right, for individuals and corporations to spend money independently on political activities. They can't necessarily give unlimited amount of money to candidates, but they can spend it independently. So if the state government tried to say that corporations cannot participate in political activities, it seems like there would be a conflict. Now, I'm trying to think if there might be a twist where you can't give money. No, because there was an attempt, Wyoming, I want to say, that tried to put a state law in place saying that people could not give money to judicial candidates or severely limited the ability to give money to judicial candidates and judicial campaigns, and the federal court struck it down. So, I mean, the analysis is always going to be, do we have a conflict with the U.S. Constitution? If the Supreme Court has taken a position on the constitutionality of a particular thing or it's recognized as a federal right, states are going to be in a tough position. I mean, an example of that would be flag burning. Okay, Texas put a law into place, place late 1980s. They wanted to, they essentially wanted to criminalize and punish instances of flag burning. Federal government, I mean, the federal courts took up the case, ultimately ruled at the Supreme Court that flag burning for a political purpose was protected political speech, and as such could not be regulated by the states. Texas law was struck down. Federal government then tried to do it. Congress tried to put a law in place. Supreme Court came back, protected activity. Once the court made that ruling, the only way that a state could then regulate flag burning or punish flag burning would be to change the Constitution. And I think that that's part of the issue with Citizens United. I mean, they've taken a pretty clear position, which is political money, the spending of money politically, is political speech, and it's protected under the Constitution, which severely limits, if not eliminates, the ability of government, whether we're talking federal, state, or local, to set rules in place about the expenditure of monies by individuals or corporations politically.
And the Supreme Court claims the authority to make that decision.
Well, if you go back to, you know, to Marbury versus Madison, it has been essentially a basic premise of our constitutional system that the Supreme Court has the final say on all things constitutional, the whole basis of judicial review. And judicial review, no matter what you might have read, John Marshall didn't make it up whole cloth, okay? We had judicial review in our state and colonial courts before the Constitution. It was a part of the Anglo system. So the idea that judicial review the idea of judicial review was not sort of made up. Also, if you think about the three-branch system that we have, this idea of separation of powers, if judicial review is somehow illegitimate, then you have to say, well, then what in the hell do we have the courts for? Where's the check? Where's the balance? Okay. Under our system, the Supreme Court has the final say. And sometimes we like that, and sometimes we don't.
Could you comment on the conflict between Michigan's decision about affirmative action versus what's going on at the federal level?
Well, yes, I can. And one of the things that you have to understand when you look at these kinds of issues is the difference between a court decision that says a state can voluntarily engage in behavior versus a decision that it is mandatory that a state do a particular thing. And what the court has said previously is for states, governmental entities that wish to engage in affirmative action, race can be one of many factors, okay? That has nothing to do with whether or not states or localities have to use affirmative action. It only says if you wish to, then these are the rules associated with it. My understanding is that what you have is you have a state law in Michigan saying, it's a provision in the Constitution, I think, no affirmative action. And the federal the courts have never taken a position that there's any that the states can't choose not to do that. They've only said that it, I mean, in other words, the issue is not forbidding affirmative action unconstitutional, even though that's sort of the argument here. It's not going to go anywhere, okay? But you know, the issue has never been is forbidding, up until now, affirmative action unconstitutional. The issue has been how far can states and localities constitutionally go in using race as a consideration? And the U of M case from 2004, the court said, we're willing to accept race as one of several considerations, but it can't be the only consideration. This new case, which is not allowing for affirmative action, is somehow racial discrimination. I mean, if you want my opinion, it's doomed. That argument is not going to prevail. What did you think on it, or what's your?
I don't have an opinion on it.
I don't have any interest in this Alabama situation or necessarily want the Ten Commandments in our courthouses.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see how the Supreme Court would rule on the First Amendment to outlaw that, because Congress or there should be no law establishing religion, which they're naming the Ten Commandments as religion, and then they're banning the free expression thereof, and Alabama is a separate corporation, separate jurisdiction. I don't see how they got away with that as the basis for it.
Well, the Supremacy Clause is the reason that the constitutional prohibition on the establishment of religion was imposed upon Alabama. Now, if you want to argue that there is no constitutional basis for enforcing the Establishment Clause, or it's being enforced in a way that the framers didn't intend, that's a whole different kind of argument. I think that there's lots of historical perspective and historical support for the idea that the framers did not want the government to be in the religion business, period. And I think it's particularly interesting to me that while the framers were probably all Christians, or at least espoused Christianity, may or may not have been personally devout, they made a very deliberate decision to create an aggressively secular document. Okay,
but is that how they ruled, that they had supremacy based on the U.S. Constitution in the First Amendment?
Well, that's Article 6. That's what we went through at the very beginning tonight, is that when you have a conflict between state government, state law, state action, and the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Constitution prevails. And so you had Alabama saying, well, under our Constitution, we can do this. And you had the court saying, but under the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, you can't.
Also, one other thing, mm-hmm. the idea of buying insurance as a tax.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, calling that a tax. I mean, some people just don't want health insurance, don't want to buy it, don't use doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And I also see that as unconstitutional under a lot of amendments.
We're back to the same issue of Citizens United, in that we have a court ruling. Some people really hate Citizens United, and so we don't like the idea that the Supreme Court gets to have the last say. Other people don't like Obamacare, and so they're pissed off that the Supreme Court said that it was legal. I mean, that is the nature of our system. And ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court has the final say. If you can get jurisdiction maybe with God to review their decision, good for you. But in our system, the U.S. Supreme Court has the final say on all things constitutional. So when you have a dispute between government and the Constitution prevails. When you have a dispute between the state, a particular state, and the U.S. Constitution, the Constitution prevails. The U.S. Supreme Court says Obamacare is legal. They say that it is a tax, and the federal government, under Article 1, Section 8, has the ability to tax. You don't like that. Other people might like it. They said that spending on political campaigns in pursuance of political views is protected speech. Some people don't like that. Some people do. I mean, that is the nature. All of us would like to be able to seat a court that would always decide things in exactly the way we like. Doesn't happen that way.
I was wondering if you'd comment on the chances of the Michigan constitutional provision purporting to insulate pension from deduction versus the ability to discharge a contractual debt in federal bankruptcy law?
Bankruptcy? You know, I'm not particularly knowledgeable about bankruptcy law, so I'm not sure. I mean, one of the arguments that gets put forward is that you have these contractual agreements within the state of Michigan between the city of Detroit and their pensioners. I'm sorry, I can't give you any insight on that. It looks like, I mean, just from a perspective that any of us would have by reading the news, it looks like they seem to be crafting together some sort of agreement around the DIAR, around pensions for the retirees that maybe may address some of this. We'll see.
The Commerce Clause gives Congress the right to regulate commerce but not mandate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
With the Affordable Care Act, they are, in effect, mandating commerce. Let me finish.
Yeah.
They are mandating commerce, and instead of paying a fine, you pay a tax. Doesn't that allow, by doing this, doesn't that allow Congress to require any kind of economic behavior?
Okay, let me two things here. First, when I shook my head, it's not me. The Supreme Court said that, okay? Supreme Court said this isn't allowable under the Commerce Clause. It's not about commerce. However, it's about a tax. Now, I have to be very honest. I thought that when the Obama administration began to promote the ACA and they were debating it publicly, I thought they were being, as we say in the Midwest, too cute by half when they tried to suggest it wasn't a tax, okay? They bent all of it. Oh, it's not a tax. It's not a tax. It's not a tax. And then ultimately it gets challenged, and all of a sudden the only way it's going to be constitutionally legitimate is if it's a tax. Oh, well, then it's a tax, which actually raises a different problem, which I don't think the court's going to take it up. But constitutionally, in the legislative process, all revenue bills, bills that affect taxes or revenues to the federal government, must start in the House. Most bills can start in either place. They just have to go through both houses, identical form, and then go on to the president. And, in fact, the Affordable Care Act started in the Senate. So, I, as I said, I don't think that that's going to be a court challenge. Who knows? Maybe it will be. So, I'm not going to get into did the Supreme Court get it right. All we're doing is sort of the legal lay of the land.
No, I'm not interested in that. I understand that. My mm-hmm. question is, by doing so, purchasing insurance is mm-hmm. commerce. It's hard to call it anything else.
Mm-hmm.
By doing this, doesn't that allow Congress to require all manner of commerce, such as purchasing whatever, and calling it a tax for not doing it?
Right. And I am again saying that that's what the Supreme Court said, that the Affordable Care Act and its sanctions for not buying insurance were a tax and were legitimate under the Constitution. I don't want to get into what does that mean down the line. Okay.
The Supreme Court does actually overturn itself rarely.
Sure. It does happen.
Yeah. How politicized are the courts in Supreme Courts historically and today? And
how politicized?
Yeah. What keeps them, when these guys get into office,
federal courts,
do they set aside their political opinions?
Well, federal judges are appointed for life. Okay, they can be removed through impeachment for the usual constitutional reasons, treason, bribery, high crimes, and misdemeanors, or they can also be removed for essentially unethical behavior. Federal judges serve, what's the term, in good character or in good behavior. There you go. So there's an additional way to remove a federal judge. You know, I can't speak to how politicized they are. I can speak to the issue of subsequent courts overturning earlier decisions, and that does happen. In the early 1900s, we had Plessy v. Ferguson. Separate but equal is perfectly acceptable. The government can essentially provide for disparate treatment between certain groups. Brown v. Board of Education said, no, overturned it, set a new standard. And so over the course of time, we see that some Supreme Courts will overrule previous law. Sometimes people point to that and they say, well, that's wrong, that somehow there is a static set of rules that can never be addressed, that essentially once that Plessy v. Ferguson court made its decision, any change in that would somehow be politically motivated and therefore unacceptable. What we have in our system is that precedent is usual, but it's not absolute. We would expect that courts would be guided by previous decisions, but it is not absolute, and we do see Supreme Court decisions overturned by a subsequent Supreme Court and standards change.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, in the article which addresses the Supreme Court, how many justices did it say or did it not say? Why do they choose 9?
Let's
and
take
I
a look.
Know in FDR tried to add some when they were decisions weren't going his way. So how did that originate?
I'm not sure. Let me take a look. Okay. Now, one thing that I do find interesting that most people don't know is that the Article 3 creates the U.S. Supreme Court and no other court. So the U.S. Supreme Court is a constitutional creature. All lower federal courts are congressionally created. So Congress creates them. They could end them. They could change them. They could decide tomorrow that we don't need a D.C. circuit, and they could change that without having any constitutional problems. So U.S. Supreme Court constitutionally mandated, all lower federal courts created by Congress, regulated by Congress. So let's see. Judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. Doesn't say how many. And the answer is, I don't know. Statutory? Yeah, Roosevelt, essentially his argument was, well, we have these aging justices, and so what we're going to do is we're going to appoint these other justices to help them. Even the Democrats in Congress who wanted to do just about everything they could to help Roosevelt implement the New Deal said, nah, we can't do that.
I have two suggestions. One is that the state incentivize recycling by providing units of government sort of a reverse grant based on the percentage of natural production of trash or recycling, so that the more you recycle, the more money you get. And the source, perhaps, since the state is in budget trouble.
They've got a surplus.
They got $1 billion surplus, of two-thirds of which is a one-time surplus.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a bill was just introduced today to lower our taxes.
For all time, based on the one-time surplus, yeah.
By a tenth in succeeding years, one-tenth a percent each year succeeding.
Yeah.
So
your one point was incentivize recycling.
And you get the money. A possible source of money is to raise the tipping fees. These are two separate acts, independent. Could that happen?
But you have to be careful. Now, I'll give you mentioned recycling. At some point, apparently there was an attempt of the state of Michigan to say, well, you know, the good hardy citizens of Michigan, they're good stewards of the environment, and they recycle, and these slobs from Canada do not. So that we're going to use our reserved powers of protecting health and safety and our environment here. We're going to use that as the basis. Remember, we're looking for a state power that's going to justify. We're going to use that as a basis for rejecting this out-of-state trash. And the court said, oh, wait a minute. Recycling's not required. It's not mandatory, is it? Well, no. Well, you're going to make it a law? Well, no. And so, essentially, the view is this is subterfuge, okay? If what the state is trying to do is to find a backdoor way to regulate commerce, to interfere with interstate or international trade, federal government is going to fight that. So any sort of scheme that's put into place is going to have to survive that scrutiny. Is it a real-life attempt to address this problem and address the environment and all of these kinds of things, or is it some sort of ploy? And, I mean, that's what the court's going to look at. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just curious, the title of your talk was The End of the Constitution? Or
that was the first one.
Okay.
We talked about the fact that we're moving away from sort of the language and the basic promise of certain constitutional provisions.
Do you think we should move away from the U.S. Constitution? Okay, and the other thing, I was just curious as to why you think Obama's speech will motivate certain states to want to withdraw.
Well, because I think, and this is something we're going to have to see play itself out, but I think that when he sort of throws down the gauntlet and says, I'm going to do these things through executive power, I think that is something that should cause people concern. He may very well be able to do things in a way that's constitutionally appropriate, because we certainly have recognized and we know that the president has certain powers, certain kinds of authority that he can exercise. But I think that when you have sort of this sort of almost belligerent, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do what I want through executive orders, I think that you're going to see, you know, states essentially say, we're not, whatever you say, we're not going to do. So that's kind of where I thought it would come up. That's the one thing that sent off, you know, my little antenna. I started to twitch.
Do you think that's a good thing?
No, I don't know. I mean, I teach, the course that I teach at the University of Michigan is Congress and the President. That's what we spend the entire term looking at is what powers do the two branches have? What does it look like when they clash? What has the court said about, say, the powers of the president as commander-in-chief, inherent powers, specific powers, recess appointments laid out in the Constitution? Presidents have done things very differently than what it says in the Constitution. Supreme Court now has a case in front of it. And I always tell my students, the worse it is for the country, the better it is for this class. Anytime I see some big conflict in the air, I'm like, oh, yay, this is going to be so good for my class. And so I think when the president, you know, asserts this kind of authority or sort of gets his back up and says, I'm going to do these things and there's nothing Congress can do about it, I think we're going to have trouble. Just like when George W. Bush said the same thing, and ultimately the court slapped him several times about the kinds of things that he argued he could do independently, he could do without congressional approval. And sometimes he said, and there was nothing Congress could do to stop him, or nothing the courts could do. Essentially argued in many cases that his power as commander-in-chief essentially put him above the law. And the Supreme Court stepped in several times and said, mm-mm, it's not the way it works. So I try to be, I really try to not have my views be based on who the president is or who the Supreme Court is. I look at, is this a reasonable exercise of presidential power? What does the Constitution say? What has the court told us? What's the legal lay of the land? Doesn't mean I don't have personal opinions about all this stuff, but when I try to do analysis, that's how I look at it. Yeah, he's got one more follow-up.
Yeah, ultimately, people have the right to dispose of their own government when it.
Yep.
And Yeah, I just wondered, looking at the federal government, we're in wars all over. Mm-hmm. They have nothing to do with their national security. We mm-hmm. have regulatory bodies like the FDA just going into corporations, doing whatever they want. So we not only have Congress, the executive branch, but regulatory branches just, you know, bypassing citizens and their rights and their constitutional right, their okay. birthright.
Well, just one comment that I would make, because the issue of you know, how our system should be set. We have a system where we vote. We all participate. But this issue of being at war, one of the things, and I talked about this a little bit last time when I talked about sort of the dynamics of presidential ascendancy. One of the things that have put presidents in this dominant role, which the Constitution really doesn't envision. We see this sort of exquisite balance. But when you have a president that exerts much more power and Congress lets the president do that, we have a problem. And one of the things that has created that situation is the fact that we have been at war nonstop since the Constitution was put in effect. One of my groups of students is putting on a presentation next week. I gave them a document that is this thick, which catalogs every military engagement from the Revolutionary War on. We have never stopped being militarily active. It has always been such. It's amazing. Yeah. Okay, one more question, then I've got to go because I got to meet with a group of students at U of M who are presenting tomorrow.
As a former school board member,
mm-hmm.
could you talk about the No Child Left Behind and also Obama's plan and the federal hiring and firing teachers based on a federal overview? Do you understand my?
I understand, but I don't know that I have any particular insight to talk about that. It's not really a constitutional issue. So sorry. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.